Lifestyle.
You'll forgive me if I don't stay around to watch. I just can't cope with the freaky stuff.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the New Flesh Podcast. A podcast.
It sounds old-timey somehow.
Yeah, it does. A pod gasp feels more on brand for us. This is one of those ones I'm not going to go back and start over. We're just going to barrel through with the mispronunciation and the bits. It's in the New Flesh Podcast, a podcast about horror movies and all things tangentially related to horror, horror movies, and the horror lifestyle. And Jesse, I can say this actually now, officially, again, the only active podcast named the New Flesh Podcast.
We did it. We destroyed the other one.
We have destroyed the other one. They haven't posted since January, and I assume it's because of the negative karmic energy I was sending their way.
Yes, every week. Yes. Also, the demon that they the demon that we unleashed by doing spells, and that will not in any way come back to get revenge upon us.
Definitely not. Everything's looking up for us at the New Flesh Podcast, the only one that exists. We do horror movies, we do horror news, we do horror franchises, we do, my mic makes weird noises, and I hope
signature,
that
signature, yeah.
Yeah, signature, that's kind of part of it. Part of our thing is audio issues. 10 years of, like, bearing with us on the audio problems.
I'm going to contribute my own because I'm upstate, I'm recording this from upstate New York, and it's... you thought my street noises were bad because I live on a busy street. Well, my mom lives in a nice little small town where people do their lawns all day. So look forward to some mowers, look forward to some bird cheeps, which I think will be appropriate ambiance for what we're going to talk about.
The and Cure just... might walk by and be playing acoustically.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they're going to be playing a deep cut too, not like... Not
every
like
night I love. Burn! It's the only one I know right now. It's just I'm too steeped in the Crow lore to know any other Crow Cure songs other than the one that's on the Crow soundtrack. So, you know, the lead not quite buried here. We're talking about The Crow 2024 today. Despite the on-ramp of coverage of the entire franchise that I hope to lead into this, due to a heavy horror schedule in the marketplace of movies... We have not covered... I like to blame this on the schedule as if I could not have planned around that. There's just no way to know when horror movies
are going to drop. You think they have some kind of list of when things are coming out?
No.
We're flying blind every week.
Every week you show up at the movie theater.
Show up at the multiplex. Yeah.
What do you got for me?
Yeah.
So it's just...
That's walk-up business,
it didn't. Walk-up business industry. Is up. And it's because people love the thrill of not knowing what the fuck is going on. We're here to talk about the new Crow, and I have a programming note update. You guys all know, hopefully, that the Crow City of Angels, the Crow sequel, the episode that we've already recorded, has been up on the Patreon as an early release while this scheduling kerfluffle gets worked out. And by that, I mean, we wait for a lull in the schedule so I can put that episode out on the main feed. The kerfluffle of my making. City of Angels, we had Scout Tafoya on. It's a great episode. The update here is that we've also recorded an episode for The Crow 3, The Crow Salvation, which I think you'll be very surprised to hear at least one person's opinion on that movie. That is maybe not what you expected to hear. I love that episode. It has Bill Bria. He hasn't been on the show in 5 years. I think he was on for the 47 Meters Down Uncaged episode many moons ago, and he came back to talk about The Crow Salvation in a positive light. And you know what? I'm not going to say if he's right or not, but that episode is on the Patreon as well. There are two early releases now available on the Patreon. both those episodes will be out on the main feed eventually, but it's a real question mark as to when. You can check the release schedule for movies if you can find one online and try to figure out where we're going to slot it, but you never know. We might find some release you haven't heard of to throw in there. And there's a second programming note here. So there's all those bonus early releases. We're doing a bonus main feed episode this week because there were so many movies that came out this weekend, frankly. If you listen to me on my other podcast, Roger and Me, my fake Siskel and Ebert show that I do with Mark Dusick, film critic in Chicago, there was 15 movies that Mark covered for Friday, and I covered 11 of them with him. And there were several genre movies among them. So not only are Jesse and I covering The Crow today on its own episode, because God damn it, I feel like it deserves it after the buildup we attempted to have for it. We should at least do a whole episode on it. And I think you and I are going to have an opinion that's way outside of the mainstream on this movie. So we should really lean into that and just talk about it at length. So today is The Crow, and then midweek, to be recorded today or tomorrow, frankly, it will be recorded the day after this drops, and it will be put out probably the day after that, because I don't want to ruin the numbers for the pod. We got to let this one simmer, let it marinate on the feed. We're going to put out an episode on two other movies that came out the same damn day as The Crow, which are Strange Darling and Blink Twice. Blink Twice is the writer-director debut of Zoe Kravitz, and we have J.T. Molnar, I believe, is the filmmaker who did Strange Darling, and it was shot, and by that I mean the cinematographer is Giovanni Ribisi, beloved character actor, which, you know, we'll talk about all that on the second episode of the week. So you are, you know, not lacking in new flesh content this week. We've got a lot going on, and we're going to, you know, we're just going to give it all to you. And that early release, if you can't wait for The Crow, you got to get on the Patreon. That's basically the news. Jesse, you're upstate. What's going on up there?
Not a whole bunch going on up here. I did go out. I did see The Crow. I was so sad. I got COVID and had to miss the premiere, the world premiere of The Crow, which I was inexplicably invited to. Bought a Cure shirt at Target, was ready to go.
You know
what?
COVID. Had you not tested for COVID and you had gone to The Crow, I would have said you got COVID.
Yeah.
So it's probably good that you avoided that.
Yes. I just got regular COVID. I did not get limited edition COVID, sadly. But it meant that I couldn't see that one, and I couldn't see Blink Twice, which I'm catching up with tonight. So I'm upstate visiting my mom, hanging out with my daughter and my mom and my sister. And
you didn't recreate the circumstances of The Crow 94 in theaters, which you very much could have, where you and your mom saw it. Come on.
I know. It was like, it was just much easier for Marissa and I to go. She was here just for an evening before heading back to work.
Oh, sure. Okay.
So we went on a little date. My mom hung out with her granddaughter, which I think she prefers even to going to see The Crow.
I can't imagine that's like, true, but okay. Yeah.
She was like, I read the review in the Times. It wasn't good. It didn't sound good. She's not into the idea of doing another Crow. I feel like she's of the very understandable.
She's liking Alex Proyas's Facebook posts about.
Yeah, she's like, fuck yeah. I think she, like a lot of fans of the first film, is kind of like, leave that alone. That's good the way it is. I don't want to see another version, which I am completely sympathetic towards. But we'll talk about more about maybe why I am sympathetic, but there's maybe an asterisk there.
Yeah, for sure, an asterisk. But I also have feelings about this movie that, frankly, I got laughed at on, I think is the first time I've ever was like, don't laugh at me, Mark. I'm serious. I really believe this to be true. And he just couldn't believe it. So I think people's reaction to this movie is interesting. And we'll
I think
talk
it's about perhaps a little, one might say a little bit prepackaged even. Perhaps.
Yeah, it's a little prefab. We'll talk about that. But I don't think anyone's being dishonest with their reaction.
No,
I just think
brought
in what they brought in and they are mad. Like they, you know,
yes,
yeah, we'll talk about it.
It makes sense.
Except for Mark Dusick, who is he was right.
He's a cruel man. Oh no,
he's a cruel man. No, I was just saying he was. I don't want to insinuate that he was blinded by.
I think people genuinely did dislike it. I don't mean to ever be like that guy who's like, well, they aren't really saying what they believe. I would just say that It's such a this is going to be such an interesting situation because it's usually I get pretty salty about saying, you know, well, this person's wrong or whatever. You know, they don't, whatever. And this case, it's a case where I don't necessarily disagree with anything that negative that I've read about the movie. And yet,
well, that's the exact thing I had with Mark, where I'm like, yep, you're right. And here's all the things I liked, but like, here's all the things that like, the things I liked even are like half measured sometimes. It's like, they did this, but they didn't do it right. And like, it's, I can't wait to talk about it. So let's get through this, like, arguably 2 weeks of news because we didn't do it last week. There wasn't that much, but there also is enough. So let's just get right into it. I put him in an order that I think works, and I think this is probably the biggest because it's the biggest names. Jack Black and Paul Rudd are in early talks to star in a reboot of sorts of the 1997 film Anaconda that you will know, you'll remember stars Jennifer Lopez, Ice Cube, John Voight, Owen Wilson's in that.
Owen Wilson, wow.
Danny, wow. Danny Trejo. Eric Stoltz, don't do any Danny Trejo impressions. We're going to get Trejo. We both just respectful silence after Danny Trejo. He's got Trejo's Tacos, which at, do you know where I had a Trejo's Taco, Jesse? You'll be surprised to hear this, maybe. Jones Beach. The Jones Beach venue has a Trejo's Tacos stand.
Next time I go to Jones Beach, I'm going straight for the Trejo's Tacos for sure.
Hell yeah. So 1997 movie, which I'm sure hardcore heads will remember. Tell me if the year is right. I'm going off the top of my head. 2005's Anaconda's Hunt for the Blood Orchid. Is that what it was called?
I'm going to say I have never seen either Anaconda movie, but I would
what
say
the fuck is going on right now? Are you kidding me? Whoa.
I don't know how I missed this. The 97 must have.
It was like an HBO classic to me. Like, it was on all the time. Yeah.
So here's the weird circumstances. I mean, I'm not going to go into a big story. I'm just going to say the weird temporal, just that it came out when I was more likely to go with to the movies with my friends. And anyway, my parents were not going to go see Anaconda. My mom might watch Anaconda on HBO, but she probably wouldn't go out to the theaters to see Anaconda. But my friends also were not that into horror movies. So like creature feature type stuff, I didn't really see with them that much. And it came out like probably, and I think at the end of my junior year of high school. So it was just like, I didn't get to it. Like, I didn't make a big fuss over, hey, someone take me to see Anaconda because I didn't have a car or anything.
You didn't want none of that Anaconda in a
twist.
That's
right. And then by the time it would have been on HBO, it would have been about a year later. I was like knee deep in senior year and like just not, you know, I was not home that much. And it was probably playing on HBO well into my freshman year of college. But of course, as a freshman in college, I had
HBO.
Like six channels, you know, so I completely missed the Anaconda window. I should have been watching on HBO for sure. I've been meaning to, I don't know if it's on my Letterboxd to watch list because I usually keep that a little classier, but I should
Criterion
add it.
Releases only.
Yeah. It's kind of, so I can keep track of the stuff like from before 1980 that I need to see. But I do need to see Anaconda. And I would say Hunt for the Blood Orchids, completely blind. You might be right. It might be 2005. I'm going to say 2004 and see if I can be closer without going over.
Oh, okay. So, I have to check now. I had all that time.
Yeah. So no.
2004.
Yes.
2004. I saw it in theaters with friends because I was in the zone and I had seen Anaconda on cable a lot. I looked up the poster I looked up the box office, frankly, to see how it did, which is, if you're wondering, 65 domestic, 71 international for 136 total, for a movie that probably cost, you know, not that much.
I would say probably 30 or something.
Mid-budge. Yeah. And then the poster's awesome. It just has like the snake's eyes on it, much like the Nicolas Cage film. And then the tagline, though: when you can't breathe, you can't scream. That's pretty cool. Ooh. It's a kind of working on, you know, off of the iconic Alien tagline.
So that you have to wait for what they're going to do for the new one, which will be like, when breathing is hard, it's because you can't scream because of the snake or something. Yes.
They really are letting AI botch all this shit lately. It's very silly. I don't think we have time to talk about the Megalopolis trailer. I didn't pull that, but God, that was funny. There also is a second tagline on the same poster that just says, "It will take your breath away." So, like, let's a little busy.
Great. That's good.
It's
that's
a little busy.
Yeah, that is that's too much.
But, I realize I haven't gotten to the news here, but I guess
it's going to be a spoof or something, right? Or kind of a half spoof.
Yeah, according to sources, this Anaconda reboot will be written and directed by Tom Gormican, the guy who wrote and directed The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, the meta Nick Cage movie. So who else to make a meta Anaconda movie than the guy who made a meta Nick Cage movie? According to sources, the new story involves a group of friends facing midlife crises who are remaking their favorite movie from their youth, which I'm imagining is Anaconda. And they head to the rainforest only to find themselves in a fight again for their lives against natural disasters, giant snakes, and violent criminals. I think that sounds fun.
It does sound fun. Yeah. I think it's a great idea. They're clearly trying to go for a Tropic Thunder-ish kind of thing. And I think that would be great to see something that's a little, you know, that's a little Rudd and Jack Black doing something kind of silly. They should add two more guys, though. Like, you know, like get a, you know, Danny McBride and...
Oh, yeah. Like, you're just rounding out the cast of Tropic Thunder at this point.
Yeah, that's
and
true. Yeah,
Tom Cruise in a in weird garb.
Yeah. We can get like Amy Poehler, someone who wasn't in Tropic Thunder, just to balance it out.
Good call. I think that sounds fun. I wonder if we'll get a legacy element and will J-Lo return? J-Lo is in dire straits right now. Will she show up in the Anaconda reboot? We'll have to wait and see. If I know anything about this Tom Gormican guy, I think yes. This is my guess. But we'll see. Legacy sequels are all the rage these days. So last we reported on the Crystal Lake Friday the 13th prequel TV show that was an A24 production that was set up at Peacock, I believe. It had derailed. It was Brian Fuller who left the project. He was the showrunner. Now it's back on track with Brad Caleb Kane, the showrunner of the It, not out yet, the It Welcome to Derry TV show that's coming to HBO Max. Peacock had given the show a straight-to-series order in 2022. It was described as an expanded prequel to the original Friday the 13th, featuring both Jason and his mother, Pamela. Vincenzo Natali and Kimberly Pierce were set to direct episodes, with the budget ballooning to $10 million per episode. With 8 episodes in total planned, it would have cost A24 roughly $85 million to bring the series to life, with additional seasons being planned. So expect the direction to change completely now that a new showrunner is in place. He most recently did It Welcome to Derry. In addition to that, Victor Miller, who wrote the screenplay for the franchise's 1980 film, is executive producing. There's not really much news. There's like a statement from Kane saying that from the day I watched Jason Voorhees squeeze a guy's eyeball out of its socket in glorious 3D at the tender age of 8, I knew my creative path was to someday destined to converge with the man behind the mask. Nothing defined my childhood more than growing up in the golden age of the slasher flick. And nothing's defined the genre more than Friday the 13th. I couldn't be more excited for the opportunity to contribute a chapter to this iconic franchise, particularly with such fearless partners as Peacock and A24. So I'm glad to hear it's back on track. I'm sad to hear that Brian Fuller isn't doing it, but this guy's...
Yeah,
you know,
that's too bad. That would have been like a reason to check it out, but it's...
Statement didn't... I'm not saying it goes a long way, but it was nice to hear that he's like, you know...
From
the age of 8, seeing that movie. I like those stories. Let's see if he can do it justice. I'm looking forward to whatever that is. Mostly as somebody who's agnostic and not super interested in that franchise. I've seen them all a million times, and I always am like, what am I missing here? These are just kind of shoddy in weird ways. I like the later sequels. Well, you and I should really do that at some point.
I'm up for it because I've never seen most of them, so I would be up for...
I have that like Blu-ray set that I never have watched from Shout Factory that I should dust off. It even has the remake in there, the Nispel. Poltergeist TV show from Amazon MGM Studios scares up showrunners. Kalinda Vasquez of Fear the Walking Dead and Robbie Thompson of Supernatural have come on board the upcoming Poltergeist TV show. Exact plot details are under wraps, aside from the fact that the show is inspired by the iconic 1982 movie. Amblin Television is making this show. It will be an Amazon TV show, is my guess. That's all we know about that. Salem's Lot, we have an update. It will premiere on Max in October. That's what we know. There's a little, I don't know if there's a teaser, but there's like images that came out. It was a real like Entertainment Weekly style spread
of yeah.
very colorful images that hopefully won't match the, you know, the movie's tone. The movie's look hopefully won't match the color of those images. was my first impression when I saw it. Yeah, New Line's take on Salem's Lot, the 1975 vampire novel from Stephen King, was supposed to be a theatrical movie, of course. It got pulled from the schedule. Our boy Gary Doberman directed it. Thank you. yeah, still no release date. I think it's October. I don't know if there's an actual date. This Deadline article just says October now. People were fearing this would end up shelved like Batgirl, but it's coming out. And it just sucks that it's another TV movie to me, even though it's ostensibly not. It was made for theatrical, blah, blah, blah. The only Salem's Lot we have is a TV version, so we have another TV version. There you go. Great book. I read it recently enough, and it was good. Very good. Rosemary's Baby prequel, Apartment 7A, we talked about. I'm not sure if we knew that the date was September 27th. That's when it's coming to Paramount Plus. So exactly a month, we'll have the Rosemary's Baby prequel starring Julia Garner to watch at home. God bless. The poster looks cool enough. It's evocative. You know, it's evoking the original movie. It's got the color scheme. I'm interested enough. There's a movie called It's What's Inside that played at Sundance this year. It's a horror movie. Netflix bought it for $17 million, and they're putting it out on October 4th, where they will not recoup their money because they don't put movies out theatrically. So it's really stupid when they do shit like this, in my opinion. All down the drain of streaming, whatever. This movie, did you see that it's having like a screening at the Lincoln Center?
Oh, I think I saw it. I wasn't looking at my emails very carefully. I saw that it was screening. I couldn't remember. It's such a vague title. I couldn't remember if this was something that came out already and it was, they're bringing it back, or, you know, that explains it, that it was at a Sundance movie. So I had heard about it and then never saw it. And then, apparently people really liked it.
I had that same problem.
I haven't seen it. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it. It opens out the Lincoln Center one is the 16th of September at 7. So, you know, tickets are still on sale. I might grab a ticket for that. We'll see. When does it come out? October 4th? October 6th. Yeah, October 4th. We'll see. Terrifier 3 will world premiere at Fantastic Fest in Austin. The movie comes out October 11th. Fantastic Fest is September 19th through the 26th. It's not just Terrifier 3. Other genre offerings are the new VHS movie, VHS Beyond, and the Alex Aja Halle Berry movie, Never Let Go.
Ooh.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. And that movie, actually, Never Let Go, just moved up a week from September 27th to September 20th. So there you have that. That's a Lionsgate release, I believe. So hopefully Jesse and I will get screening invites soon enough for that one. Excited for all the movies mentioned, and you can check out Fantastic Fest lineup for the rest of the stuff. There's also Apartment 7A is playing there. Anora's playing there. Which, Jesse, did you get invited to that yet?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
I haven't either, but my coworkers all have, and it's driving me crazy. A Different Man is playing there, which I have seen, A24 movie. A lot of cool stuff playing there, so check it out. Teacup, James Wan's executive produced horror series Teacup, is premiering on Peacock Thursday, October 10th. There's a trailer for it and people say it looks good. I haven't watched it. Obviously, I don't do that shit. I don't watch it. E.L. Katz, who did Cheap Thrills and most recently Asriel, that's coming out soon, helmed the first two episodes. I don't know what it's about, but it seems like a horror thing. Follows a group of people on a ranch who must come together in the face of mysterious threat in order to survive. That's a generic description I can get behind. Let's go. Jesse, this is from like an hour ago. You probably haven't seen it. I will send it to you on Twitter, just so you can get a visual, because I think you also, as a nerd, will be excited to see. At Halloween Horror Nights, there's like some sort of like billboard or like poster up for the new Wolfman movie. Before anywhere else. Yeah, it's like Blumhouse, and there's basically it's just like a what do you call it? A font reveal, a title card reveal. It's just like the font.
Title treatment reveal.
Title treatment reveal. There's like a house. It's just a poster. I send it to Jesse so he can get eyes on it.
What
we know about.
There it is. Looks good. Yeah, there it is. There's
I'm
the
excited.
House.
I'm interested. I don't know what's
up
in the
house. I do
like
the font. It actually kind of looks like the font they use on the Crow poster, although not in the movie.
You know what? You're right. It is very Crow poster fonty.
They thought they were going to be riding a wave here, but that's fine.
Lee Whannell, of course, is returning to the world of Universal Monsters. The movie comes out January 17th, 2025. That was an inside Universal account. That's, you know, the Halloween Horror Nights starts next week, so that's what that's about. That's why the reveal has been. That's why the reveal was what it was. Christopher Abbott's in it. Jesse's booing. Julia Garner's in it, and Matilda Firth. And Sam Yeager, people I do not know. Writers include Lee Whannell and Corbett Tuck. Uh-oh, there's four writers, Jesse. Lee Whannell, Corbett Tuck, Lauren Shooker Blum. That Jason Blum's wife or something? We're going to have to look that up. And Rebecca Angelo. Lauren Shooker Blum was a national real estate reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Who is this person?
Until she met and fell in love with
That's what I'm assuming. Yeah, they have pictures. Her pictures are all with Jason Blum. I'm pretty that's her husband. So that's interesting. her name is on the screenplay for the Wolfman. This is so interesting. It appears, by the way, not the Wolfman. It is Wolfman, according to the poster that we just see. So Wolfman, Lee Whannell, January 2025. Check it out if you're at Halloween Horror Nights. You can see the poster. Couple Blu-ray announcements. Blair Witch Project is getting a cool boutique Blu-ray release from Second Sight, and the first of its kind offering that it offers is the original sources have been redigitized, including a first ever proper transfer of the original 16mm print, and there's a new doc by Jed Shepard interviewing all of us who made the film. The version you've seen before was, you know, high 8 and 16mm to Beta SP in 1997, edited in standard def, output to 35 from SD, and that was from the a 35mm print. This DVD and Blu-ray, besides the new edition, was a video transfer from that 35mm print. So everything, that was the past, and now they have this new one from the original 16mm. This is the best version, allegedly. So it's a two-disc set, the original theatrical cut and the festival cut, plus the original release version, new audio commentary, directors and producers commentaries, which I'm assuming are the old ones, deleted scenes, alternate ending, the Con 1999 director's interview. This sounds like a great release. Second Sight is putting that out on November 11th, and it's $50. And those things sell out and become like $400 objects that are on eBay. So if you're interested, you really should buy it. I'm back to buying boutique stuff after like going to digital for some things for only like I'll buy a new release in digital for $5, you know, for 4K, whatever. Now I'm like, well, I'll buy all the boutique. I got like Showgirls Vinegar Syndrome.
Oh, nice.
And shit like that, which I'm now like, where is it? It's on my desk somewhere, and I thought I threw it out and panicked, but it's right here. The other 4K Blu-ray thing is Nightmare on Elm Street is coming out in 4K. On October 15th. It'll be out in digital on the October 1st, but the disc is out on the 15th, and it has both cuts of the movie, the theatrical and the uncut version that has 8 seconds of the unrated footage. I'll let you look up what it
eight
is.
8 seconds?
Yes.
Wow, yeah.
It's an iconic 8 seconds. There's two commentaries, alternate endings, all the special features from the past, and it has the iconic cover that I love, the poster that I recognize. Fede Alvarez says he has ideas for sequels for Alien, and you know what? After the performance, don't you think he's going to come back?
It seems possible, although he didn't even do the sequel to Don't Breathe, so I mean, I don't know. Maybe.
He executive produced that, but I feel like him... Yeah, I wonder what he means by we have ideas, if he means, like, I'll shunt it off again. I think he's such... From my impression, just following this dude on Twitter since this movie's come out, he's like such a hardcore fan, which I think comes across in the movie to the point where people don't like it. And I think I enjoyed the fan service because it felt genuine from a fan and they nailed the atmosphere, et cetera, et cetera. There's real sets. But yeah, I just like that it feels like he's a fan who got to make his favorite thing. And now he's like, yeah, I can do another one. Let's fucking go. I don't know how I feel. I hope they clearly will make another one.
Yes, this is the... it kind of opened to some, not that far off from where Covenant did, but it seems to be holding up a lot better, and it seems like it's kind of a bona fide hit.
Holding a lot better, and internationally, do you see it's bolstered by like weird overperformance in China? Like it's made it's made like $80 million there already. It's doing really really well. So it's lopsided. It's like 72 domestic, 150 worldwide right now, or 150 international for 225 worldwide, and that's only after 2 weeks. So this movie is doing great.
Yes,
and it's outperforming Covenant. It was, isn't it so funny to think that Prometheus is the highest grossing one of those before this?
Yes, it's because, you know, because they're spread out over so much time. If you did it by inflation, I'm sure it would be a different story.
That's
true.
That,
for that sure. Prometheus is everyone's favorite. Prometheus.
Well,
the
in my mind,
an alien.
Yeah. It was like the big mistake of that movie's like marketing. In my mind, was like they didn't sell that. I'm assuming they did in the marketing actually sell that it was an alien movie. Like people must have been aware because why else would it have done that well? Like, were people just interested in an original sci-fi movie called The Prometheus?
Do you think there was a little bit of a zone where you could get away with less franchisey leanings? Like, the summer before that, Super 8 was just like J.J. Abrams doing a Spielberg-like thing, and Spielberg's name is on it as a producer, and it did about the same amount of money as Prometheus. So I feel like there was a little bit of a zone in there where there was a little bit of just, like, cool, you know, Ridley Scott sci-fi, like, you know, J.J. Abrams sci-fi adventure, and like people would show up, and that's just very hard to picture now because that's just not happening.
Prometheus came out now without, like, before all these other alien things happened. I feel like it would not make that much money. It's really crazy to think about. And that movie holds up for me in so many ways. And I was rewatching Covenant. I've been rewatching Covenant for like a week, I feel like. And that movie, underrated in terms of just like top tier visual effects, like just like
it does have really good visual effects. I like it in general too.
It's really great. But like then there's like just like the like whatever the spaceship is doing with like its shields, so it's like charging, like all that shit just looks incredible. It's like it was just Ridley Scott and his crew, fantastic. Anyway, Fede Alvarez also explained why Romulus was going to go straight to Hulu at some point. It was a reaction to, of course, theaters being gone. It was deep in the heart of the pandemic. Decision was not made at the point when theaters were healthy. It was always going to be an ambitious movie for streaming. I'm really glad that it didn't, because, you know, this and Evil Dead Rise, right, are the two best examples of, I guess, Smile also, things that were built for streaming that, like, made a fuck ton of money. And you go, would you rather have $300 million or nothing? Like, it's just so fucking outrageous to me that it was even ever a thing. Disney had to learn that lesson the hard way, and now they're back big time. To the point of things that were once made for Disney, meant for Disney Plus, now, like Moana, a TV series, is now Moana 2, and will be in theaters, and will probably gross $1 billion, right? Like, it's...
I think that movie's going to be massive. The kids have been watching Moana for 10 years now.
Yeah.
They love it. They can't
my wife
enough.
Put it on yesterday for the baby, and I feel like this is the first time she's seen it since Hamilton. Since seeing Hamilton, and she's just like, is just fucking Hamilton. Like, all the songs are so Hamilton. I guess that's like a thing that Lynn was dealing with for a while, where everything sounded the same.
Yeah, I love the soundtrack to that. I'm a little sick of it because I've heard the soundtrack so many times, but it's a good bunch of songs. I could even credit, this is not necessarily material for a horror podcast, but the one that Jermaine sings.
Yeah,
the
I'm sneak. What is it? I'm spice. I'm shiny.
Yeah.
It's very David Bowie.
Well, exactly. It got my, first of all, I was so impressed because when he was singing it, I knew there were a couple people who worked on the soundtrack. I thought, oh, well, Lynn probably didn't do that one. That was probably Jermaine, because he does that kind of thing with Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah,
they did a pretty good Bowie.
Bowie's in space, etc.
Yeah. And then come to find out that he just sang it. It was Lynn did the lyrics, and I think someone else worked with him on the music. But we played that for when my daughter was very little. She really loved You're Welcome, as all little kids do. And then I just was like, well, let's hear the next song on the soundtrack, because you've seen the movie and stuff. And it was Shiny, and she really liked that. And then that I put on David Bowie because of that. And she, when she was a little kid, she ended up really liking David Bowie because that was kind of her gateway into that. So I have so much appreciation for what Moana was able to do in terms of making sure I wasn't listening to The Wiggles with my kid for a long time.
We got The Wiggles going.
Moana and David Bowie, yeah. Well, yeah. Play her some Bowie. It might be like, oh yeah, this sounds like Shiny.
It's a great point. AMC's Fear Fest, the cable channel, every October, obviously, they go hard with horror programming. It's worth noting that last year's ran throughout September and October. They just said stay tuned. It just says actually all October long. So it seems like they actually put it back to only being October, which we should write letters and like be mad at them about it or something. So next year that they come back hard. Long Legs is available now to rent at home. It is PVOD prices, I'm sure, but you can rent it. You can buy it on digital. The disc is out September 25th. And even though I didn't like it, it's got a commentary track, and those 4Ks, even the fucking neon ones, sometimes go out of print fast. So I ordered it for $25, even though I don't like it that much. The movie has grossed over $100 million globally. Can you believe that?
That's wild and very delightful.
71 at the world, US, 100 million worldwide. It's so cool, to the point where we haven't mentioned on this podcast, I'm sure we haven't, because it's not horror. Nicolas Cage's next project is playing John Madden in a John Madden biopic directed by, what's his fucking name? Isn't it the
David O. Russell.
David O. Russell. Yeah. That's like a huge leap for Cage's career art, you know?
Yes.
It's cool. And I can't wait to see what that looks like, frankly. Like, what is him as John Madden going to be? That's so interesting. Other things at home. Trap is coming digital this week, Friday, August 30th. And I wanted to mention, if you're in Chicago, on my birthday, it's Friday, September 13th, it's Friday the 13th, and Chicago's Music Box Theater, presented by our buddies at the Halloweenies podcast, are doing a Friday the 13th marathon of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8.
Wow.
Yeah, all back to back to back to back to back to back. With it's presented by Paramount Scares, which is Paramount Pictures little horror division that they do stuff under now, and I think it's just so cool that that's happening. So if you're in Chicago, I don't think there's 35 millimeter prints as of now that I saw, but like, it's a cool event. You should support it, check it out. I already mentioned there's multiple horrors out this week that Jesse and I are going to review on a bonus episode. There's another one called Hellhole that's on Shudder. It's from the Addams family, if you know who those guys are. There's this family that makes really cheap movies in the woods with each other, husband and wife and their kids and stuff. And they've made what's it called? Something in the Dirt was one of theirs. Hellbender. I really like Hellbender. And Hellhole, I didn't like that much, but I reviewed it on Roger and Me. Check it out if you want. There's this movie called The Becomers. Zach Clark's The Becomers. He's directed great indie movies like Little Sister. He has a new movie. It's like a COVID era comedy, sci-fi comedy genre-y enough. I enjoyed that. But Jesse and I will be back later in the week to talk about Blink Twice and Strange Darling. Two movies, or Strange Darling, it seems like, is like everyone's seeing, but even though it didn't have a box office impression, it feels like my entire circle is seeing it.
Yeah, and my sister goes to the movies sometimes, but often just like when I'm around, I'm like, hey, you want to go to the movies? We're going to go see Blink Twice tonight together. But last night, while Marissa and I went to see The Crow, she and her boyfriend, who never goes to the movies, were like rolling out for Strange Darling.
So I think buzz. Is it just not getting reported or something? Like, it's just not, it's not listed at all.
Oh, I saw it did a million over the weekend.
Oh, okay.
According to thenumbers.com, which, you know, on 1,000 screens is not even that terrific, but it's been made more of widely available than you kind of would assume, and I feel like that's allowed a lot of people to see it a little more easily. It's even, you know, in New York it's on more than one screen, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm upstate and it's at the multiplex here, so I feel like people are able to, people who might say, oh, I want to see that, and then look in their area and find it's not playing, are actually able to go out and see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a movie released by like Magenta Light Productions. Like, it does not have a normal distributor or anything like that. And yeah, I had a friend text me and asking about it, and he saw it, and he was like, I went to go see Blink Twice, and I saw it was playing, and I saw it instead. And I thought that was so cool. It's breaking through. It's just like the IFC Shudder thing, where they're just like, put movies in theaters now, and market them a little, and see what can happen. And this one seems to have like that, what do you call it? Like, kind of, I mean, they're definitely paying for digital ads and stuff, but like, it's very low, just like riding on people's praise of it. Like, everyone's, it just has hype, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, and it's doing well. So we'll talk about that movie later in the week. So now let's talk about The Motherfucking Crow 2024. Man, it's here, it's out. If you've been listening to this podcast since 2015, first of all, thank you, you're awesome. Second of all, we've been talking about this movie ever since then. It has gone through many incarnations, one of them being Jason Momoa and another one being Bradley Cooper, Luke Evans, Jake Huston. I'm trying to remember other directors that were attached.
Norrington was attached. There are so many executive producers at the beginning of this movie's very oddly ordered credits that I was convinced for a while that everyone who did a pass on the screenplay or was attached to directing it or expressed interest in it somehow was awarded an executive producer credit. Lots of movies have a lot of executive producer credits, but I wish I had counted from the beginning because I didn't realize, oh God, it's still going. There were probably 18, I would say, executive producers credited in this movie. It's nuts. And I assume some of that is from a long development process that probably a lot of people's hands touched along the way.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen Norrington, the director of the original Blade, which I think is one of the best fucking comic book movies ever. I think it's so unsung just because people always go Blade 2 because it's Guillermo del Toro. Stephen Norrington's Blade fucking rocks. In 2008, December 2008, he said to Variety, I'm writing and directing a reinvention of The Crow, whereas distinguished between the 1994 by saying, whereas Proyas' original was gloriously gothic and stylized, the new movie will be realistic, hard-edged, and mysterious, almost documentary style.
Sorry.
Yeah. Documentary hilarious. Style. Hilarious. And then like it just like went through a bunch of stages of different like changing hands of productions, whatever. And then in July 2010, one of my favorite musicians ever, Nick Cave, who does music for movies and occasionally... I don't know if any of his scripts have ever exist. Or actually, wait, The Proposition's
his
script,
he wrote
it?
The Proposition.
Yeah, I fucking love that movie. I almost forgot that he wrote The Proposition because the stories for me are like, he wrote Gladiator 2 where Russell Crowe's character battles in hell after death.
Yeah.
And that it's called like Hell Eater or something and it's never been made. So apparently Nick Cave was brought in to revise the script and in October 2010, it was Mark Wahlberg who was going to get the role.
You guys don't care about The Crow? You guys care about this crow? They say, when somebody dies, I'm like not a good...
Say how do you know that for me, okay? Yeah. Stephen Norrington stepped out of the project, and on April 2011, Juan Carlos Freinadillo was chosen, who did 28 Weeks Later, which I think is a cool movie. Tucker Tooley of Relativity was chosen to serve as executive producer. Who cares? Meanwhile, Bradley Cooper was in talks for the lead of that one. And then F. Javier Gutierrez, who his debut ended up being Before the Fall, which was many years later, right? Like,
okay, yeah, yeah.
Because he did shorts and stuff. He was in contention, but did not get it. And then Alex Say, the guy who wrote Wu-Tang and American Saga eventually. All these guys who hadn't done anything, who like eventually did something. Anyway, eventually additional rumors were scheduling difficulties with Wahlberg, so it was Channing Tatum or Ryan Gosling, and then eventually James McAvoy, and then Freinadillo departed in October 2011. And then in 2012, that Gutierrez guy was hired, and it fell apart. I'm trying to see if there's any other things worth mentioning. There was a version that screenwriter Cliff Dorman was listed for a page one rewrite, which ultimately got the project greenlit. Director courted production designer Bo Welch, effects artist.
Bo Welch.
Yeah.
He's great Burton associate.
Yes. And Barry Sonnenfeld associate. But yeah, Burton's the real one for sure. FX artist Rick Baker, musician Atticus Ross, before Ross was doing shit like this, right? Makeup designer Bill Corso. On April 19th, 2013, it was announced that Tom Hiddleston was going to do it. And that same month, it says he was not going to do it. And then Alexander Skarsgård was going to do it. In May 2013, what's crazy is like these things were reported in the trades, right? Like these were like things that were happening, including in May 2013, it was Luke Evans. And then Luke Evans affirmed that it was going to be as faithful to the original as possible, blah, blah, blah. The original creator, James O'Barr, was named as a creative consultant. And November 2013, it was reported that Norman Reedus was up for a role of another character named James. Kristen Stewart was at runtime considered for the part of Shelley. Location scouting took place in New Orleans and the United Kingdom. And then Gutierrez signed on to direct the movie Rings. Okay, he directed Rings, that really bad sequel to The Ring, which had forced him to drop out. And then Evans eventually dropped out. This is so crazy, man. what else happened? Jack Houston was in talks to star. I don't even know who that is. Boardwalk Empire guy, I guess. In 2015, Andrea Riseborough was in talks to co-star as the female version of Top Dollar. On June 2015, two stories. Forest Whitaker was in negotiations for a role, and Jack Houston had dropped out. But they were looking at Nicholas Holt and Jack O'Connell. The Hollywood Reporter then stalled. The reboot then stalled because of Relativity Media going bankrupt. And then James Ibarra saying, "Don't worry, it's still going to happen." Then it was 2016 when Jason Momoa was meeting with, I think, Corin Hardy, who was going to do it for a minute, that Irish guy. And then it was retitled The Crow Reborn. Sony was going to distribute it. It was going to shoot in Budapest. And then due to creative differences, the director left. And yeah, and now here we are. I think that's where
the
we
long
are.
Road. Now it's all come down to this. It's all come down
to Rupert to Sanders.
Movie. Yeah,
director Rupert Sanders, who you may know from Snow White and the Huntsman and Ghost in the Shell, the live action version, and Bill Skarsgård as the Crow, and FKA Twigs, the musician. As is her name even Shelley? I guess it is. Yes,
Shelley. It is Shelley. Yeah.
As Shelley, and Danny Houston as, on paper, such an awesome villain, and I love the guy, but boy, is he giving nothing to do. But we'll explain why I think the character is a good idea. You just tell me. You were taken with it a little more than I was, and I was frankly taken with it for the first 40, like wholesale, and then it loses me with some choices. But then I was won over by the end again. Like, I thought the through line of the gothic, tragic, doomed romance hit so hard for me in this movie. I think because it has 40 minutes of setup and is a coherent movie, unlike the original, which is better because it's a stylized thing that it's has like a mood and atmosphere.
The first one is such a great mood piece and is such a great vibe and is such a great performance from Brandon Lee, none of which this movie has. But I agree about the first 40 minutes and beyond even. I saw this with my wife, and she's not a particularly big fan of any of the Crow movies so far that she's seen. And she was also quite taken with the first 40 minutes and kind of bought in. She said she's so starved for movies that have a good romance, which is so few do, that she was like, fine. Like, Skarsgård and FKA Twigs, let's go. Like, they're going to have a romance and they're going to kiss and stuff. Like, that's great. But I was with her on that. I was pleasantly surprised because the trailers, they make it look like such like dirtbag, like nu metal Crow, you know, like Korn fan. like instead of Eric Draven, his name is like Korn fan 1069 or something. who gets turned into the Crow. But I even though he is kind of painted as like, you know, a face tattoo having dirtbag, and FK Twigs is sort of flaky and weird, I did find them affecting as this couple, and it's a nice novelty that you actually get to see the two of them together. It's not like, oh, you really get a feel for their day-to-day life. They're still kind of living as, you know, lovers on the run, you know, that kind of dynamic. Like you said, the gothic, tragic romance kind of thing.
Yeah, I wrote down lovers on the run as well.
Yeah, yeah, it has that vibe. But, you know, those things often are interesting, like Badlands and stuff like that are interesting and work. And this isn't as expansive or beautiful as Badlands, of course. But, like, it's the kind of young outlaw thing, except they're not even outlaws so much as, like, you know, I guess you kind of learn something about her where that's sort of the case. But it's more about their, you know, feeling like outcasts from society and having been dealt a shitty hand by their crummy families. And
it has the Rob Zombie remake opening, frankly.
Yeah.
It has the flappy-ass tits opening, without saying.
Yeah. And it's a little more, no offense to Zombie, whose movies I've come around a bit on, it's a little more lyrical than Zombie can sometimes summon, just because it doesn't have that much dialogue in it.
100%. I'm totally kidding. But at the same time, I was like, this is giving Rob Zombie remake vibes.
It has a fucking horse, just like Sherry Boone. And isn't she like have a horse in Halloween 2?
She does have a horse in Halloween 2. Yeah, I just mean it was so funny to see, like, okay, so it's a Crow reboot, and in the Crow reboot, we're seeing the Crow as a child, and he has an abusive mother, or an absent mother, or an alcoholic mother. They don't give you much, but they give you a taste.
Yes. Yeah, and it's interesting to see them take that technique from the first Crow, which is applied to their actual relationship, and sure, give that to him for his childhood, and then dive into their relationship between Eric and Shelley, who meet in a really kind of fancifully imagined, like, it's like supposed to be a rehab facility, we find out, but it's a little more like Arkham Asylum.
Yeah, why are they all wearing pink? It's very confusing.
Yeah, it's very strange. But I like that kind of, I was like, yeah, that's the weird vibe of this thing. And there is a little bit of Joker and Harley Quinn to them. She's not as zany as Harley Quinn, and he's like the shitty Jared Leto Joker.
We're in sync. I also wrote down. You can't not think it. It's definitely
he has, like,
evocative.
A tattoo with the same font on his face as the
he's
Jared Leto Joker.
Very much giving Jared Leto as the Joker.
But the difference here is he really is kind of a sympathetic figure. He is kind of like, oh, what if the Joker wasn't like super obnoxious?
Yeah. What if he had to kill a horse once and it was sad and it ruined his life? He got
the dead horse stayed
with him, the fear of things close to you dying, you know, whatever it is.
And he does. It's like this, the opening there is like it's a combination of that scene from War Horse where they rescue the horse from the barbed wire, and the part in Never Ending Story with the horse where it sinks into the swamp.
Never seen it.
Yeah, oh really?
It always sounded too long to me. I never wanted to watch it.
It is, you know, it's not never ending. It's only 8.5 hours, so it's very
well, that's reasonable.
Yeah, it's like the Decalogue or whatever. He is weirdly sympathetic, Eric Skarsgård, because he's not as good as Brandon Lee, and he's not as, you know, sort of charismatic or strange, who also has Joker vibes. So I also felt like there was continuity there, like, okay, yeah, this is a different version of the Crow as the Joker. But I was kind of involved in their relationship. I found them kind of sweet in a kind of dirtbaggy, doomed way, and I thought FKA Twigs, who I was, like, I have to admit, kind of worried about, because she has a weird vibe. But
she has such a unique face. Like, it's like a lip shape thing. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. She has
mouth
a kind
shape.
Of a,
yeah.
It is a weird thing. Like, and I found that when she's actually acting in emotion, I was like totally with her. And even though I was like, wow, she's quite beautiful. And then she's just the kind of actor where she has a strange enough face where if you use her as sort of just the image of her face, she kind of looks slack-jawed and like, I'm like, who is this zombie? Like, but they even use that kind of well in the movie when they make her part of like the images that he's seen. And then when she's giving her actual performance, I did think she was quite good. I found she kind of helps along the, whatever is lacking from him not being as charismatic as Brandon Lee. It's helped along by having another character in the story.
Showing the romance that's supposed to be the inciting thing. Like, I'm just saying, the original Crow, they make such a big stink about Shelley and him being like love, like how, you know, they were lovers and how they were soulmates kind of thing. And how it's so tragic that they died, but they don't fucking show it to you. Like,
right. I think that it kind of works in that movie, sort of, you feel it more by its absence than anything else. You see, you know, it sort of is a stand-in for, like, any kind of loss you could have experienced, and you kind of get that from Lee's performance, and there's kind of it's a choice, and it doesn't always work that well, but I think it ultimately does come off as sort of like, okay, yeah, you're seeing the absence of her more than you're seeing her, but you can't really do that again and have it necessarily be effective. And this movie does a really nice job of saying, okay, well, we got to actually show them together to make you feel that loss a little more. And it really does, that first 40 minutes really does work pretty well, with the exception of any time that a Crow movie has a cutaway to an establishing shot that's just like a normal city during the day. My heart just sinks.
I know.
It's just, you should never see that in a Crow movie. I don't mean that, like, you have to do a Crow movie only one certain way. It should only look one certain
miniatures.
Way.
Get some fucking miniatures.
It just has to look like something besides just, like, here's the exterior of a city. I'm like, what the fuck is this? You need, if there's an established shot, it needs to be, like, a crow flying over some kind of crazy miniature. Something should be on fire.
Something's dripping.
Raining. Something dripping, yeah. It should be night. Why the hell is it day? You know, that, like, there's not a lot of, you know, there's some cool sets in the movie and some or cool set design that's some, I'm sure, digital, mixed of digital and practical stuff. But it's nothing near as immersive as what you get from the first two movies.
The visual style, if you could call it that in this movie, which I'm telling you, there isn't any, because just in terms of, if you're comparing this to the original Crow, it doesn't have any, but it does have a visual style. And by that, I mean, it looks like a fucking Screen Gems movie, baby. It's blue. It's got that blue. I knew Jesse. I texted Jesse sometime this week after thinking about it for a bit. I'm like, that movie was just Screen Gems-y enough where I'm going to call Jesse liking it. And I was right.
It could have been bluer as far as I'm concerned. I saw this at a local upstate multiplex, which I love going to, but they often run things pretty dim.
I thought you were going to say, turn up the blue.
Turn up the blue. Yeah, I was up there going, come on, turn the blue up, turn up the blues. No, I think I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if some of their auditoriums just have a 3D cap on all the time. That just kind of
dark dimness. Shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there were things that were just like fairly hard to see.
It's either that or bulbs not being changed in years.
Yes, exactly. Like yeah. Neither would surprise me at all. I was probably missing out on some blue tint stuff because there was kind of, when I was looking at it, was kind of dingy looking. But even within that, like the sets are really largely unimpressive, and those exterior shots are just heartbreaking. But it does have, there are some moments where there's must happen in a Crow movie, the two of them are killed, and he goes to this kind of in between place. That's basically a train station.
The fucking train station, dude.
I thought it was cool, actually.
Oh, really?
I like the look of that set. I thought that was an
interesting to piss you off because you know that guy he's interacting with?
Yes.
Do you know who that's? Who know who that is?
I kind of figured based on what something you had said earlier, it's supposed to be the skull guy. From
it's the fucking Skull Cowboy. If you remember, we made a whole big stink on our original Crow episode about an element that was cut from the movie. Which they said because the CGI of the face that they did looked stupid. They didn't want to use it. But the Skull Cowboy is exactly as described. It's like Sam Elliott, but with a Ghost Rider face with a skull on fire or whatever. And he's wearing a cowboy hat. And he's like his spirit guide, kind of. So in this movie, they have the idea of a spirit guide. But it's just a fucking guy. It's just a fucking guy. It's just a fucking dude. A dude named Kronos. Who pushes him into a puddle every now and then.
Like, yes, occasionally he nudges him into a puddle. I will say, I don't know if it was just because I liked the actor and hadn't seen him. I probably have seen him, but just don't remember, but hadn't seen him to my knowledge before. The guy playing Kronos, whose name is Sammy Wadilla, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry if I'm mangling his name. I think it's like a Latina name.
Well, he mangled the Skull Cowboy, so.
Yeah. Well, I kind of liked him. I kind of liked him, and I kind of liked the train station. You know, it's kind of like they do that in Harry Potter, Nerd Alert, where like Harry gets killed and goes to like a train station. Like, kind of, or I was thinking also of Matrix.
No, hey, you're thinking Harry runs into a wall and then goes into a train.
Yeah, there's like he goes to like that same station in sort of a purgatory afterlife kind of way. And I was thinking of Keanu in Matrix Revolutions going to that train station. I think I like the idea of the train station as the kind of the waypoint between worlds. And this is kind of a nice foggy, puddly, you know, crows everywhere.
It looked pretty digital to me.
I mean, it doesn't look great, but I thought, okay, at least that's like showing a little imagination in terms of, okay, this is the look they're going for. Whereas when they go back to the city for a lot of it, it's just like, it's even more than, Crow Salvation is worse looking because it's lower budget, but like even more than Crow Salvation, it's like, this is just a random city. Because I think they did shoot it in Prague or something.
Well,
it doesn't capture any feeling of like of architectural distinction until actually that sequence towards the end at the opera house, which I thought was a really interesting idea and choice. But a lot of that's like the main drawback for me is this movie doesn't have like any of that, even Crow City of Angels atmosphere, that would have helped it a lot. But I was into it as a like genre-y, you know, doomed romance and then revenge movie. And something else I really dug about it is when Eric comes back,
horror lifestyle flourishes. Are you about to tell me the good shit? Yeah,
absolutely. And also something that contributes to that is the fact that he sucks shit at being a vigilante.
Yes, dude, we have the same exact notes. I wrote, I love his arc from he sucks at this to eternal sad boy gothic crow who now can do murders very well. And the lore change that comes along with that we can explain at the end, because I think people are saying there's like too much lore, it's like making up rules, and I'm like, I actually think if you're a Crow fan, they do really interesting stuff here.
I agree
with that. So all right, I agree entirely. The biggest issue with this movie that is like an unforgivable sin basically that I can't even get over in my praise of it is that it just doesn't have that tangible, that fucking physically attained, like physically achieved production design that had that fucking visually stunning and just visceral everything, so emotive. It didn't need fucking story or dialogue. You know what I mean? It just it just kind of existed as this object to behold. And there's nothing like that here. But when you lose that, you gain some coherence in a story. And I think the story, I agree. I think it works as like, this is the base Crow story done in a way that is not as visually stunning at all, but is telling the Crow story in a way that I think works. Like, I found it, and we'll just get into spoilers at this point on, if you care about that shit, because I think most of you have seen this. Or even or you've seen the old one at least, and
or you're just not going to,
or you're just not going to. But you know, there's so much to love about I think where it ends for him, and like the character choice he has to make, and how much more gothic and tragic it is in this version. The like the ending that he gets and what it means for the character. Like I think it. I just really was like for a movie that's just like. To me, more so doing like a response to the legacy of the Crow, which to me is like a sad boy goth thing, even more so than the original movie was doing, maybe. Like, it's like leaning into the like, what do people associate with the Crow? Like, to me, it's like, yeah, sure. Like, gothic, tragic, doomed, sad dudes. And I just appreciated the through line through this movie setting up this romance, it making you care about it. For me, I totally found it effective and emotional. And then in the end, doing what he does, which we can fully spoil in a second, like, I just think it, like, it tells its story and it tells it well in that regard. Like, I'm totally ignoring the things I don't like about it, but it, just in terms of storytelling and arcs and stuff, I think it's really satisfying. Am I crazy for saying that?
Okay. No, I found it a little bit bumpy in some of that stuff because, so he comes back and is kind of, he's like getting by a lot on the fact that he can heal. I do actually really love the detail that they make more explicit. They kind of, it's a little more watery in the other Crow movies about whether it's kind of the Wolverine thing when, in that thing I love in X-Men, the first X-Men where she goes, when she's talking about his claws and she's like, does it hurt when they come out? And he goes, every time. And in this one, he still gets hurt. It still hurts for him to get shot and like cut up.
Oh yeah, and I love that. Stuff. That underlined the tragic gothic sad boy thing for me. Like,
exactly.
He's getting hurt. He loves pain.
Yeah, he's getting all this pain, but he keeps going because he does heal quickly. But he's sort of cursed to this life of pain. And so he comes back and he's getting by a lot on his vigilantism is like getting by a lot on the fact that he can't be killed and not so much on his particular skill. And then he sort of gets killed again, I think. And this will be spoilery if I'm correct. And I think I understood this correctly. Is the idea that he loses faith a little bit in Shelley because of what he finds out about her, and therefore he's able to be his like love for her is diluted and is not completely pure because he has doubts about her, and that allows him to be killed essentially, or kind of half killed and sent back again to the purgatory and the train station with the Skull Cowboy. That's like a really interesting idea. I don't know that the movie like completely earns the back and forth of like, okay, he's dead, he's alive, he's dead again for this other reason, and now he's alive again because he very hastily struck a random bargain that I didn't think that this guy in the Skull Cowboy guy equivalent really was in the position to make. You know what I mean? Like, it just, that felt to me a little bit convenient, and a little bit, that kind of felt to me like a hasty rewrite or a combination of two ideas, or, you know, a multiple draft of the screenplay situation. Maybe it wasn't, and maybe it was just kind of sloppy writing from the jump. But that I didn't really love. That just felt a little bumpy to me. And I actually, Marissa watching it, like, felt when he came back the second time, she was sort of like, this is just like guy doing horrific violence, like, and he's unstoppable. But I see that point, but also really love, like, that sequence at the Opera House where he's like,
cool,
and gets a sword.
I have no idea why, like, he has a sword. It's awesome that he does, though.
And like, he suddenly knows how to use, like, he suddenly gains a little bit more.
Well, yeah,
valid,
there's something,
you know,
to
skill.
Like, I was going to ask you, like, in your mind, like, this is all spoiler alert at this point. In your mind, like, he's not the Crow. Is he not the Crow to you until he, I guess not. I don't think
he doesn't really put on the makeup until then. So maybe that's, you know, he's kind of the training Crow before then, and he has to really commit to
being
the Crow.
It's like when Spider-Man's the human spider.
Right. Yeah. When he's in the wrestling costume. Yeah. And that also, like, I thought it was cool. It was a cool choice to delay that, but it does also feel a little like, okay, you're giving me the whole origin story about a character who is like, is not going to continue into multiple movies. So why are we doing a whole movie about the origin? But But I do think it worked kind of in the moment of like, oh yeah, okay, now he's got his crow powers and it's kind of under a different condition. I just like didn't 100% understand why. It seemed like the offer on the table initially was that if his love remained pure, they could both just come back to life if he killed everyone, which seemed like, that seems crazy to me, right? Like that's...
Oh no, that's what you thought of this one?
That's in his the kind of initial situation, right? Like when he first goes back and they basically say, if your love for her remains pure and you kind of smite the enemies, I think they basically say, because I remember thinking, what's the catch? Because he basically says, he says something to the effect of, you guys will be together again. I thought maybe it's going to turn out to be together in the afterlife.
Oh yeah, no, I 100% took it as you can just be dead with her again.
With her. Maybe that's what they're after. But then that also makes it like, the two offers to me don't really fit. Like whether it's you're both going to come back to life or you're both going to be dead together. And then the second offer is like, well, actually we can bring one of you back to life, like full stop, but you have to trade. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess you're right. If you get caught up in that stuff, it's one of those things where if I think about it, yes, it will fall apart entirely.
But like as a dream logic thing where he comes back and like his, you know, he hasn't had any, you know, training, but he sort of understands better how to use.
Well, it's like his love for her being the power of it, I think, is what it's supposed to be. And again, I'm just going all in on like the romance of this tragic, dumb bullshit. So like, I wasn't thinking about any of that. I was kind of struck by the idea that, you know, he basically says, I'm like, there's this thing established, which we haven't talked about the bad guy yet. The bad guy is super, is like vampire, like kind of.
Yes. Or
he's immortal. And I like the way he at first goes about it because you don't really understand it. He kind of just is like, I've been here for such a long time. And you're like, okay, so he's immortal before they eventually explain what's going on. But he basically, this bad guy has made a deal with the devil essentially. That in place of him being in hell because he deserves to be in hell because he's a bad motherfucker, he's immortal and he's going to send innocent souls to hell because innocent souls, not just anybody. That's the thing. It's not just like he's sending any souls, specifically innocent souls, because innocent souls like taste better or whatever to the devil. Yeah. Like they do better. they get them off more. Like he's getting rapists and murderers all day down there. So having good souls
finally
is enticing.
Some good fucking food. Yeah.
Yes. It's really exciting and tastes different for sure. So I loved that idea, but like the execution of it, just like Danny Houston walking into rooms and talking on phones, like he doesn't. There's nothing there, right? Like they don't really do a lot.
No, it really doesn't work. And like the thing that sort of challenges Eric's love for her and for a little bit is that he sees a video, which is the reason she was, because the story kind of starts with her. I mean, he starts with them as a kid, but like the present day stuff kind of starts with her being pursued by these bad people. And the reason we find out is that there's a video of him whispering to her and using his devil influence to get her to kill someone. And she kind of goes zombified and does it. And she's horrified by this coming out, but also horrified. I guess her friend gets the video and wants to expose Danny Houston. He also doesn't want to be exposed, so he's going to come after them to get the video. But it's so bizarre because he's like, if they find this, I'm ruined. And it's like, I guess, because he does kind of stand idly by while even if you don't believe the supernatural stuff, he stands idly by while she murders someone. But like, it's pretty obtuse in the video what's going on to a layman. So like, why would he be ruined? And why he just is like this old dude hanging out with kids and whispering? It's like, I mean, it's so obvious. It's supposed to be unsavory. But again, that's another thing where I wouldn't even say it's the lore. I would just say it's the sort of like, what is supposed to be going on, and why does this person want this thing?
Yeah, it's
why
not. Is this thing it's important? Not particularly it's, well done. Not
no.
At all.
It's sort of it's, and that's those are the kind of the things where I'm kind of going, okay, well, I can't in good conscience say this is like, oh, this is really good. They really nailed this. But there's other stuff about it I like, so I don't mind as much. But that Danny Houston stuff, I think I agree. It's such a great idea because, as we joked about on the Crow 3 episode that's on the Patreon for now, the Crow in the other movies always like happens to come across a bad guy who like just like knows a bit about the supernatural or occult.
Yes.
So it's never someone who's that phased by the fact that a guy has been risen from the dead by a crow. He doesn't, mind you, he doesn't know that much about it necessarily, but he's like completely unsurprised when it happens. Like, oh, okay, he came back from the dead because of a crow. Yeah, I've read about this, is sort of the tone that they take. Fred Warren, especially in the third one, is just like not at all shocked by the fact that the guy he put to death has come back from the grave. So it makes sense that just like, and then you have to try to figure out a way for the final boss battle to have like stakes, because like the Crow is invincible and the guy, even if it's a bad gangster, he's still just like a dude, right? He's usually someone who's like older than the Crow, and not, Fred Ward doesn't seem like he could like beat up the Crow, you know?
Right.
So they do a smart thing here where they say, well, make the bad guy supernaturally connected. And that sort of feeds into, okay, so that kind of creates a world where you can make these kind of deals in terms of him saying, you know, I could trade my soul for Shelley's, basically. If I, you know, if I, you know, stop this guy, then you'll bring Shelley back, which is a really beautiful kind of gothic notion.
Yes.
And I really like the idea.
No, go ahead. Yeah. I had nothing else.
I was just like, I like that. That's, you know, tease up a squaring off with this devil guy, which makes sense. And then I even kind of liked, although this doesn't really, they don't really take advantage of it though. He doesn't really fight the demon guy, right? He just kind of like confronts him the same as if he was a gangster guy, except there's even less of a fight scene. I don't mind that. Again, it's not like I need to see Danny Houston there, like doing fisticuffs with the Crow. Yeah. Like, it's not going to be that exciting. No offense to Danny Houston. He just, you know, that doesn't seem like a guy who's that difficult to, for like a young guy to beat the shit out of. Even if he wasn't the Crow, I feel like he could probably beat the shit out of him. Eric Skarsgård seems scary, man. I feel like he could probably do it. He's wiry. That's when they say in the Fight Club, skinny guys fight till they're burger. So I feel like
You think Alex Skarsgård's mad that Bill got this because he like 10 years ago was going to do it at some point?
Oh, he was?
He was one of those names I mentioned. Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, of course. Yeah. No, he probably feels like he dodged a bullet because like this movie's not going to help anyone's career. But I'm sure when he first got it, he was like, what the fuck, dude? Made some awkward Thanksgiving, family Thanksgiving. They're Swedish. They have some other holiday probably.
Awkward whatever holiday. Yeah. Yes. Insert awkward, Swedish holiday.
You know, a feast of the of the harvest or whatever.
Yes.
I kind of like that it doesn't all come down to a big stupid battle between him and Houston, but at the same time, it does kind of feel like a wasted opportunity. Danny Houston has like the power of the devil, and then he just like gets dragged down to hell, and like that's that. There's no, it's not. Once again, the final battle ends up being kind of anticlimactic, which doesn't matter that much because the coolest action sequence is that long thing at the opera where he's wasting dudes with a sword and chopping people's hands off, and one guy tries to kill himself and he stops him from doing it with his hand.
Yeah, I love that.
There's lots of good gore. Like they've seen the wounds, you know, heal themselves in kind of quick but agonizing detail is really cool.
Which is something we briefly maybe touched on but haven't harped on, which you said, like, you know, he sucks at being the Crow, but and like takes a lot of damage, but like the body horror element of it is what makes this Crow stand apart, and like I appreciated that. I think when we talked about the Crow 3 or something, I was like, he finally feels like a corpse, and in this he feels like a corpse more than ever. Like you're aware that you're watching a guy that was risen, you know, come back from the dead. And like when he gets hit by a fucking truck in this and his like leg is all fucked up. And
it's at one point he has to like put his stomach or something, one of his organs. He has nudge back into his stomach.
Like it's
nasty stuff.
That stuff was fun and unexpected for me. Like I did not know. I did not see that coming. And I appreciated that a lot.
You kind of expect what we talk about a lot is like bad CG blood splatter. And there is plenty
of that too.
But,
yeah.
But there's also like some really gnarly gore to it. And I also really dig that they have that sequence at the opera house. My wife was like, remember in Mission Impossible where they had to do everything really quietly in Rogue Nation to make sure the opera wasn't disrupted because they would blow their cover? And in this movie, they're just like firing guns all through the opera and nobody notices. But I like that, you know, usually the Crow showdown goes down in like some big warehousey thing, you know, got crumbling warehouse, like you said, dripping, you know, on fire or whatever. And this one, they do kind of a nice flip where they have it go down in this really opulent, rich, you know, fancy, beautiful opera house. And he's getting increasingly like disgusting and bloodied up along the way. Yeah. Like there's blood everywhere. I thought that stuff was that is very fun gothic horror stuff and like and novel. Like there isn't really a scene like that in the other Crow movies. So I was very into that.
I'm surprised Mark was making fun of me for thinking the relationship stuff works so well, because like I'm thinking about it again and I'm like, the Crow's always had like his little poems and his quips that he says. And this one's like, she's a musician and he has writings. And she's like, what are these poems? He's like, oh, they're not poems. They're just things I write down. And she's like, they're like making music together before they, I think it's so cleverly done and cute. It's just like a meet cute that works and lovers on the run, etc. It just works for me. So like the through line of this movie ultimately being that he said he gives his soul for her to return. What could be more like gothic romance student lovers tragedy than that? And like, it follows through on it, and it doesn't like, it doesn't sugarcoat it or like give it, you know, it doesn't undercut itself in any way in terms of it being like just that dark.
No, I appreciated it that. It really does a nice job of having accepting that as the ending, and like that there is something sad about that, but also like getting kind of a happy, not I wouldn't say a happy ending out of that, but getting a satisfying ending. So it doesn't feel like it's just a tragic wallow. Like as much as he is like a sad boy character, it's not just like, woe is me at the end. You know, he sort of is coming to terms with, okay, well, I did something good. That was to bring her back.
Exactly. He's coming to terms because he's just pain. Endures pain. He's the guy who endures pain for what he believes in and what he wants, and it's just for her to be happy. If you buy into it, it can be very powerful.
I found it sweet. Like she has, you know, you see at the very end, she like has a little music career going, like, and it's kind of I found that pretty much worked for me and was very sweet. I was, and
for how effusive I'm being, I want to be clear. 2.5-star movie for me.
I give this the highest possible Crow sequel rating.
Yeah, it really, like, I didn't even give it the 3 out of 5 pass. I really ended up, I always was 2.5, and I feel 2.5 because, like, every element I like, there's, like, 15 things I can complain about, too. Mostly that this movie shouldn't look like ass, and it mostly does. Like, it just, when you're comparing it to The Crow, it just is hard to be excited about it. But, like, if The Crow 94 had this exact arc into the story and told the way that it is with the visuals of Proyas, like, that's a perfect movie for me. And I'm like, yeah, that's my classic movie. And I think both of these are flawed. Like, I think the original is flawed for the reasons, like, that are, like, a tragedy happened on set and it scuttled how they made the movie. And there's, like, big chunks of you need to know who these people are and you just don't. And, like, stuff like that. Yeah. There's definitely problems with it. There's fucking tons of problems with this. So, you know, between the two of them, I think someone could fan edit. No, you can't really fan edit that. I guess you know who could? Alex Proyas, who makes a lot of AI slop right now. He could fucking give whatever AI prompt to turn 94 Crow, make 94 Crow, but with these parts. And I would, I think that is my...
That's your ideal Crow situation. Keep in mind, I don't know if you've seen Crow Wicked Prayer yet. I haven't.
Yeah,
so
it's
maybe
fucked
that's
up.
What you've been looking for.
Yeah, I have to, from what I understand, the Crow Wicked Prayer does have a supernatural style villain as well.
Okay, well, that's
which
good.
I'm interested in seeing. And we'll talk about that with Andrew Overby of the Authorized Novelizations podcast soon. That'll be out, you know, on the Patreon. I can tell you it'll be out in like 2 weeks, but everywhere else I don't know. But
who's to say?
2 and 3 are already there.
I was willing to give this the 3-star pass, absolutely. I do think there are some problems with it. It definitely is not going to replace The Crow 1994 in anyone's affections or anyone's library. You know, like, the movie you want to put on to, like, watch a movie and really drink in, like you know, sort of stuff that speaks to the power and possibility of cinema, the 94 Crow, not to overpraise it, because it's not like one of my favorite movies or anything, but I think that movie comes closer just because of the sheer, both the combination of Lee and the Proyas direction and production, Alex McDowell production design. It just is hard to beat. This one, nowhere near that. But at the same time, I do have a lot of affection for it. And I think as a retelling of this story, it changes enough to it doesn't feel like a kind of one of those retreads where it's not like the Thing remake prequel where it's just the same thing.
Yeah, like, but that's not how the Crow 94 does not end this way.
Right, right. The whole, I mean, their whole story is completely different. In like, it's a different bad guy. It's a different, they have different situations. It's different personalities. Like,
and yet really, they all try to shoot that damn crow as if it's going to stop
him. And I don't know. I just don't understand. I almost actually don't understand, I guess that's the IP of it all. But, like, why are they even called Eric and Shelley? I don't think this is more faithful to the comic. The way that would be kind of the reason to keep the names. Otherwise, this plays much more like one of the Crow sequels in a good way, in that the Crow sequels are all different people coming back from the dead. This guy doesn't seem much at all like Eric Draven we know from the other movie, and she doesn't seem much like Shelley from the other movie. And I think that's a good thing. Like, I like these characters fine in their own right. Like, I think it very much to me plays like having, and again, not having seen Wicked Prior yet, maybe that one's way, way better and everything I've been looking for. But this one is really like, oh, if this were, you know, I don't think it would have been a big hit in 1996, but like this to me, even though it doesn't have the great production design that the 96 has, this is a more acceptable Crow sequel to me, that it's like a better version of like, okay, well, let's do this again, but with different circumstances and different rules and different all that, different location, etc. Like, this does a pretty good job of it, even with the handicap of the location being crap, at least in terms of how they present it. Because I think they shot in Prague or somewhere that's like genuinely quite beautiful, so there's really no excuse. Like, I think they shot it somewhere in Europe. You could have squeezed that for something a little better looking than some of this stuff. But even so, I'm pretty solidly thumbs up on it. Like, I'm not going to say, oh, you got to rush out and see The Crow. Because I feel like if any fan saw it and said, you know, no, this just isn't for me, like, I love the 1994 and I don't want to deal with this, I would say that's completely fair. Like, it's not going to replace it.
Did your ears perk up when the first song on the soundtrack was fucking Disorder by Joy Division? I was like, oh, shit. This movie's cool.
Yeah, the soundtrack is arguably, it's interesting, like, I was very much expecting, even kind of amusingly anticipating the, like, oh, they're going to try to do what's grunge, what's the contemporary version of grunge, or, like, are they going to throw it back to, like, 2000s era, like, Korn, because the font on the poster is very Korn. And what they did is actually go further back. Like, they do pre-grunge stuff. They do, like, you know, kind of, like,
Enya, it's kind Gary of austere.
Newman. Yeah. Yeah. they do stuff that's kind of surprisingly austere and grown up about it, which I thought was interesting. And yeah, I dug the soundtrack. I kind of wouldn't have minded a little more soundtrack forward moments, you know, like in the style of a 90s movie, but that's still fine.
Like a white zombie cover of I'm Your Boogeyman, maybe.
Exactly. Just or you know, the one that the More Human Than Human that they used in every action movie trailer in the late 90s, the there should have been that in the opera scene mixed together. But yeah, they're playing opera music, they're playing Joy Division. It's a real classy movie.
Oh man, yeah, I'm glad you liked it as much as I thought you would after I saw it. And I mean 2.5 out of 4 is like, it's one of the rare 2.5s that, like, I'm gonna give a heart as well on Letterboxd. So I'm like, I liked it. I just have so many reservations, and I want to make clear that the original's better, even though I like the original's probably like a movie I've rated 3 stars, so I couldn't rate it the same as that. It's like super stupid semantics like that. But it's there's so much I like about it, to the point of like I should have given it a 3-star pass, because what I'm saying is, oh, the through line of the story works fantastic. And I'm like, just kind of shitting on tons of other elements, but I really do think it works in terms of setting up that he's this tragic figure who's takes on pain, and and I just appreciated the arc ending where it does, and I definitely forgave a lot of the dumb story elements that you mentioned that don't make any sense whatsoever.
There's dumb story stuff for sure, but like, this is surprisingly like honorable, I would say, as a crow redo. Like, you know, it could have been so much worse.
Yeah, that's where I am too, and a lot of people are acting like it is, and that is what it is. People, again, prefab, it seems like people wanted to hate this. It had the built-in 10 years plus of production trouble, you know, whatever it is.
And the way the movie's performing certainly like conforms to that of like, oh, this is kind of a disaster. Like, it's crazy that this movie is coming out 28 years after Crow City of Angels, and it's going to make significantly less money. It may wind up with about as much as Crow City of Angels made in its first weekend, maybe, which is, at least in this country, which is nuts, with giving the 28 years of inflation, should have been able to at least pass it, surpass it. We haven't checked the number. I haven't checked the numbers on Crow Salvation, how it did in Spokane versus how this one played in Spokane. We should send a new Flesh reporter out to Spokane to do someone on the ground to talk to someone.
Yeah, we need someone on the ground, boots on the ground reporting. Let us know.
I do think it matches up, you know, that kind of, oh, this is a disaster, years in the making, they spent too much on it, it's a huge flop, it's gotten bad reviews. But like, the actual movie itself really doesn't match that to me. Like, this is not, even Borderlands, which I was less angry about than a lot of people. That I can see how, like, yeah, this just is kind of a mishmash that doesn't work at all, and they spent so much money on it. And this one, I'm like, no, I think this movie's heart is in the right place. Like, I don't think this doesn't feel cynical to me. Like, for whatever else you could say about it, it really. I know Proyas is going on about what a cynical cash grab it must have been, but then it didn't even make the cash, et cetera, which is fair enough. He made like this iconic original, so
he's probably going to block me on Facebook because I blew up his spot, and now I have a viral tweet that has been seen 300,000 times so far about how he is reacting to this movie. But hey, he's on Facebook in public being like,
yeah,
every day I posting mean, about how much he's enjoying it. Bombing,
and I, which I is get delightful why he feels
to watch. Yes. But yes. He's also an asshole for sure.
Like it makes sense. But at the same time, like, yeah, actually watching the movie, I didn't feel like, oh, this is a cash grab that they're doing. Like, I feel like the people who made this, even if that means Rupert Sanders is kind of a, you know, kind of a fail son bozo, like, you know, who does like special effects movies that nobody particularly likes very much. But I don't know. I feel like he actually did deliver something that at least feels like heartfelt and like a serious idea of like, okay, what can we do with the crow? It's not just like, okay, let's just give him the crow again. You know, like it didn't feel cynical to me.
I would watch a movie called The Crow again with these characters. 100%. Yeah. Yeah, I was unexpectedly taken with it despite my mixed review. I hope people enjoy at least as much as I did and hopefully as much as Jesse did. But what they did to the Skull Cowboy is unforgivable.
Yeah. You love this guy. You've never read the comics, but you love the Skull Cowboy.
All I needed was the one image I saw online of what he looks like. I was like, yes. Yeah. And frankly,
I like that you're a fan of him now.
I need to ask Alex Proyas on his Facebook page if he has any concept art for what they were looking for. Or like, I need to see how terrible of a rendering it was that it couldn't make the film. I think if I butter him up by saying, this new one sucks ass, he'll respond to me. You know? He really is all over Facebook talking about this movie. Anyway, thanks for listening. We'll be back in a few days with Blink Twice and Strange Darling, all of which, alongside The Crow, they're all in theaters now. And I think you could have a great time at the movies watching these movies, even though you're going to think differently once we talk about them next week, I guess, or later this week. All right, bye. Lifestyle.
You'll forgive me if I don't stay around to watch. I just can't cope with the freaky stuff.